Location 1, Museum of the History of Science. Welcome to our World War I walking tour of Oxford. Before we go around, please take note of the following. Please be aware of traffic as we proceed on our journey. Oxford has a very congested, overpopulated city centre with narrow roads, blind spots, and a one-way system operating in many places. There are also an abundance of cyclists. Take care when crossing all roads.
Oxford in the First World War. As you will see, Oxford had a significant part to play in the story of the Great War, and the city has numerous connections to many eminent figures associated with the conflict. Oxford on the eve of the Great War was a market centre for much of Oxfordshire and North Berkshire, as well as home to an ancient university with an international reputation. Oxford had no major single industry. There was a well-known quip that the city produced nothing but parsons and sausages. But significant local industries did include the breweries Halls and Morell's, Lucy's Iron Foundry in Jericho, and Frank Cooper's Victoria Works in Park End Street, home to Frank Cooper's Marmalade. Meanwhile, William Morris had recently opened his car-making operation in Cowley and was soon to win contracts for the manufacture of mine sinkers and hand grenades. In 1914, Oxford's largest employer was Oxford University Press, the world-famous publishing house, the main premises of which we shall see later. The university was prominent in the hustle and bustle of a city during term time. Men and women in academic dress could be seen everywhere, while sporting undergraduates hurried between colleges, the river, and sports grounds. Eights Week in May, when college crews graced on the Thames, was an important sporting and social fixture. By 1914, the heart of Oxford looked much as it does today. Many of the academic and civic buildings would appear very familiar to the modern Oxonian. Electric street lighting had just been introduced, and motor buses had replaced old-fashioned horse trams. On market days, however, the main roads leading into the city still thronged with livestock being driven to the cattle market in Gloucester Green. Just after war was declared on August 4, 1914, Oxford soon found itself awash with soldiers after a one-word telegram was sent from regimental headquarters in Paradise Street, "Mobilise." Future Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, then a Balliol undergraduate, remarked,
"The general view was that it would be over by Christmas. Our major anxiety was by hook or by crook not to miss it."
Now go to location 2 on your map, Brasenose College. Location 2, Brasenose College. You should now be at the front entrance of Brasenose College, opposite the Radcliffe Camera. This is where the University of Oxford Officers Training Corps were based.
And it was here that War Commander Douglas Haig studied political economy, ancient history and French literature between 1880 and 1883. On the outbreak of war in 1914, Haig was commander of the British Expeditionary Forces 1st Army Corps, but by the end of 1915 he had been promoted to Commander-in-Chief. In an attempt to break the stalemate on the Western Front and relieve the pressure on the French at Verdun, Haig ordered the Somme Offensive, which began on 1st July 1916. The British Army suffered 60,000 casualties on the first day, the highest in its history, and Haig's conduct of the battle made him a controversial figure. However, between August and November 1918, the Allied forces under Haig's command achieved a string of victories which led to the end of the war. At Oxford, Haig was a typical gentleman student of the time, rowing for the college, playing polo, and being a member of several dining clubs, such as the famous, or perhaps infamous, Bullingdon Club, and the intriguingly named Vampires. He returned in 1908 as a gentleman commoner, entitling him to take meals with the fellows at the high table. Some 34 years after Haig's admission to university life, Brasenose found itself contributing significantly to the war in which its formidable alumnus would play such a pivotal part. On 5th August 1914, the day after war was declared, the college agreed to give up all available beds and bedding to the War Office. There was a disagreement about the types of bedstead. The college was made available to various military personnel, though there was no long-term billeting until 1916. The conversion of Brasenose into billets threw up all kinds of difficulties. The baths in particular proved problematic. In 1915, officer cadets quartered at Wadham used the Brasenose baths at the rate of 7 and 6 pence a day, but staff complained about the soldiers' habit of leaving soiled bandages on the floor. The following year, the bursar, the person in charge of the college's finances, wrote to the city authorities to complain about lavish use of the showers by officers. Some of them were apparently refilling their basins
2 or 3 times, which is clearly unnecessary and extravagant.
In 1918, the very day the armistice was declared, the bursar wrote to the authorities again, requesting that the baths be closed on Sundays and 2 afternoons a week. Another problem was food. It was felt that certain officer cadets were making unreasonable demands. Within a month of their arrival,
9 or 10 officers were demanding breakfast in their room.
Quality of rations proved another bone of contention, with the bursar complaining,
"The quality of the ration meat continues to be very inferior. It is seldom or never fit for roasting, and has to be made up in puddings."
The College Magazine in 1917 complained that last term they had 3 meatless days a week, and no bread at dinner. In the midst of all this, the kitchen staff were feeling overwhelmed. In July 1917, the bursar pleaded on their behalf,
"The kitchen staff and other servants have now been cooking 7 days a week since August, and it is absolutely necessary that they should have holiday."
Now go to location 3 on your map, All Souls College on the High Street. Location 3, University College. You should now be on the High Street, facing the old bank building, now the Quad Brasserie. Step back against the building immediately on your left, All Souls College, so that you are not obstructing passers-by.
Across the street on the left, at about 10 o'clock, you will see University College, commandeered to be part of the 3rd Southern General Hospital in 1914. The presence of the 3rd Southern General made Oxford a major medical centre during the war, out of all proportion to its resident population. In University College's Radcliffe building, there were 109 beds for recuperating servicemen, whilst in the Durham buildings, a bit further down, another 76 beds were located. There is a notable war memorial in the chapel, listing the college's war dead by matriculation year. The years leading up to the war record a staggering number of students, but the fatality list falls off dramatically in 1915 with fewer admissions. Indeed, there were just 8 resident undergraduates in 1916. It was restricted to those with a medical condition, or from America, neutral until 1917, and Ireland, where enlisting was voluntary, conscription being held off due to the country's simmering political undercurrents, which exploded in the 1916 Easter Rising. One of these Irish students was C.S. Lewis, author of The Chronicles of Narnia, who managed to suspend his Oxford course after just 1 year in order to enlist. He experienced trench warfare in the Battle of the Somme and was later wounded. More than 1 in 5 University College students were killed in the conflict, double the national rate. The high numbers indicate many of them served as junior officers. There is one significant omission from the memorial, Rolf von Seldeneck, a former student of German origin. No names of any non-academic staff appear either. The college was converted back for academic use in 1919. There were some heated arguments about the timing and also the damage inflicted on the buildings during wartime. The walls, which had been completely stripped of their wallpaper, had to be thoroughly disinfectant before regular college life could resume. The government offered a mere £495 for the cost of repair, which the college costed at £1,200. It had to sell some of its extensive land holdings to meet the shortfall. Also on the left, at 90 High Street, you will see Patisserie Valerie. This site was owned by University College during the war and was a recruiting office.
Now go to location 4 on your map, Christchurch, Oriel Square. Location 4, Christchurch. You should now be situated at the back gates of Christchurch, at the bottom of Oriel Square. Take care to mind the traffic entering and exiting the car park.
Christchurch had many uses during the Great War. At first, the college continued much as it had done before, but gradually the numbers of undergraduates and young fellows dwindled, as mirrored in other colleges. There were hopes it would be over by Christmas, and in 1914 the college rejected a proposal to insure any of its books, pictures, or fabric. Christchurch Meadow had various military uses. The Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry were temporarily billeted here, the Oxford University Officers' Training Corps drilled here, and the Queen's Own Oxfordshire Hussars trained here. Notices warned people going for a stroll that the meadow was partially closed for military purposes. When war broke out in August 1914, members of the Officers' Training Corps, OTC, were fondly known as the Bug Shooters, after the seemingly pointless hours spent on Christchurch Meadow drilling with rifles and shooting at nothing but bugs. This was all to change. The Royal Flying Corps were also based here from 1915. In the words of Cathedral Canon Henry Holland,
"Oxford begins next week and we should be more entirely a camp than ever. Our 200 flying men keep Christchurch alive, and now and again Peck waits to quiet its historic noises."
Peck refers to Peckwater Quad, the main Grand Quad. Another part of the grounds, Merton Field, was also partially given over for allotments. Resident officers enjoyed the college's amazing stock of vintage wines, but apparently they did pay the common room for the privilege, so at least some profit was made. With regards to rationing, the excesses of high table were appropriately reined in. Meat was only served on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and guests only allowed on meatless days. Not all the dons willingly embraced wartime regulations, though, with one complaining in 1918 about turnip soup on the menu, describing it as food for cows.
Now turn around. On the opposite side of the square, at around 1 o'clock, you will see the entrance to Oriel College.
This is where women from Somerville College were evacuated when the latter was converted to a ward of the 3rd Southern General Hospital in 1915. Just off one of the quads, near the senior common rooms and library, are two passages which were bricked up in the war to separate the men from the women. Somerville students only returned to their college in the Michaelmas term of 1919. Prior to that, in June, there was the infamous raid when a group of inebriated men, celebrating their success in 8th Week, tried to get through to the other side. As it was a warm night, some female students had brought their bedding out into the quad. The commotion sent them scurrying back inside. A classics don, Miss Hilda Lorimer, appeared, resplendent in her ostrich feather hat, telling the intruders,
"Gentlemen, have the courtesy to return to your own quarters without delay."
The Somerville College principal subsequently set up a rota to guard the breach in the wall, the sentry sitting in an armchair on the women's side with a cup of coffee. It's worth noting that not everyone was enamoured of the women who chose to continue their studies. Some male dons thought they should be nurses rather than study in Oxford. Some, like the writer and pacifist Vera Brittain, were only too keen to do so, enrolling as a voluntary aid detachment nurse in 1915 after less than a year as a Somervillian, feeling that it was a much more proactive and useful occupation during wartime than studying literature.
Now go to location 5 on your map, the town hall at the end of Blue Boar Street. Location 5, the town hall. You should now be situated at the end of Blue Boar Street with the town hall to your right.
The town hall was also a part of the 3rd Southern General Hospital. After the examination schools became the base for the 3rd Southern General in mid-August 1914, the town hall initially stepped in as an additional venue for exams. There was also a mass recruitment meeting here 2 weeks into the war in the building's main hall. Eager to enlist, over 2,000 men turned up. Bear in mind today the hall's official capacity is 400. By the autumn of 1914, the town hall assembly room was being used as an overspill for wounded soldiers. By 1916, the two main function rooms, the main hall and the assembly room, and a number of other areas in the building had become hospital wards, housing a total of 205 beds. As the war progressed, the town hall devoted itself to the treatment of soldiers stricken with malaria. Lord Kitchener had made the decision to ship afflicted soldiers back to specialist hospitals in England for long-term convalescence. Over the many months of recuperation, soldiers would have undoubtedly become restless, and the town hall did its best to keep them occupied with a large billiards table, lectures in the courtroom, and even embroidery lessons. There was also a sizeable library in the building, and sometimes the new theatre would send performers over to entertain the men. In the building today, there is a certificate expressing the appreciation of the Army Council for its use as a military hospital between 1914 and 1919, and also plaques to the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry and the Queen's Own Oxfordshire Hussars, a yeomanry regiment in the British Army, with which Winston Churchill, born in nearby Blenheim Palace, would have strong connections throughout his life. The town hall, along with Oxford's many military hospitals, was a location of significant employment for women, who made up the workforce of nurses, orderlies and catering staff. Many of the female employees kept autograph books, some of which can still be found online today, containing in them poems, messages, drawings, and most importantly, words of heartfelt thanks to the women who'd looked after them.
Now go to location 6 on your map, Carfax Tower. Location 6, Carfax Tower. You should now be standing at the foot of the 12th century Carfax Tower.
It was here the terms and conditions of the armistice were read out on 11th November 1918 by the mayor amidst city-wide celebrations. Amongst numerous clauses, the armistice stipulated that all occupied lands in Belgium, Luxembourg, France and Alsace-Lorraine, held by Germany since 1870, must be given up. That the Allies were to occupy land in Germany west of the River Rhine, and that Germany would surrender a vast number of battleships, submarines, armaments and locomotives. Germany would be fully blamed for the war, and significant reparations would be paid for all damage caused.
Oxford received the official news of the signing of the armistice soon after 11 on Monday morning, and the joyful tidings spread like wildfire throughout the city. It is not quite certain who actually first received the information. In anticipation of the news coming through, a large crowd had assembled in St Aldate's, and, about 11, they heard the sounds of the singing of the national anthem coming from the interior of the post office. It seems that this was the staff of the post office singing the anthem, in accordance with the previous arrangement by phone with other post office staffs. Later, the tolling of Great Tom by order of the Dean served to confirm the news. About 6 o'clock, the mayor, who was accompanied by the town clerk, proceeded to Carfax to read the terms of the armistice, which he did in a clear voice. A huge crowd had collected, and they received each clause of the terms with tumultuous cheering. Cheers were given for the soldiers and sailors, for the king and queen, and for the mayor, and there were loud boos when an exciting individual wanted to know what was going to happen to Big and Little Willie.
Now go to location 7 on your map, Victoria Court, just off George Street. Location 7, George Street. You should now be standing in Victoria Court, a small paved area separating the Bella Italia restaurant from the new theatre.
To your left, between Debenhams and Bella Italia, stood what used to be the Young Man's Christian Association, YMCA. This was the main wartime provider of recreation facilities for soldiers and cadets. Men in uniform automatically held war membership of the YMCA, and the main building at 10 George Street provided a lounge, library, billiard room, plunge and shower bars, entertainments, debates and religious services for which attendance was voluntary. The building became so busy, soldiers were putting 2,000 letters a week in the postbox, that additional premises were acquired above 2 George Street in March 1916. Disaster struck in January 1917, when the main building was severely damaged by fire, but temporary premises in Cornmarket Street were put into use within days. Some rooms at 10 George Street were eventually made reusable, and the YMCA opened additional buffets at the new recruiting office in St Giles and at Ashurst War Hospital in 1918. On the right is the New Theatre, a popular entertainment venue during the war years. Despite losing 29 employees to the war effort, the theatre continued to put on plays and entertainments throughout the war and welcomed wounded soldiers free of charge to some performances.
A number of variety artists here at the New Theatre last week gave a performance on Friday afternoon to the wounded soldiers at the 3rd Southern General Hospital. The artists gave their services and the performance was much appreciated. Oxford Journal Illustrated, Wednesday 30th of September 1914.
However, while London theatres responded to war with some reduction in ticket prices, the New Theatre was criticised for not following this lead. One correspondent to the Oxford Times in October 1914 suggested that
a pit at 18 pence and stalls at 3 shillings would considerably increase the takings and the net profit.
During wartime, a huge array of variety artistes graced the stage, from jugglers to singers to ventriloquists. Here's an example of a typical night's entertainment.
New Theatre, Oxford. Variety entertainment twice nightly, 7 and 9. Tom Lloyd, popular eccentric comedian. Noels, harmony and ballads, ragtime and chorus songs. Horace Wheatley, the genial Irishman. The Three Whims, American club juggling speciality. Bioscope, depicting all the latest events of the day. Jackson Moore, refined entertainer and elocutionist. Dezo Cordy, cello virtuoso and company, including Miss Renee Thorne. The Continental Girls, presenting a smart vocal and thrills act. Popular prices of admission, Oxford Journal Illustrated, Wednesday the 9th of September 1914.
Now go to location 8 on your map, St George's Place by the Odeon Cinema. Location 8, George Street Cinematograph. You should now be situated on St George's Place, somewhere between the taxi rank and the Odeon Cinema entrance.
Cinema going became an increasingly popular activity during the war years. The first cinema in Oxford was the Electric, opened in 1910 in Garstle Street, and by 1913 a further 5 had taken root around the city. For the price of threepence, audiences could enjoy films featuring the emerging stars of the day, such as Charlie Chaplin. One fan of a silent movie icon was Lady Ottoline Morrell, the famous society hostess who lived in nearby Garsington and would drive into Oxford to see his early films. Her love of Chaplin is recorded 3 times in her autobiography.
In winter, our drives generally were towards Oxford for shopping or a cinema. Charlie Chaplin, in his early films, he became indeed a real figure in our life, with his laughter and sadness. Ottoline at Garsington, Memoirs of Lady Ottoline Morrell.
At the George Street Picture Palace, or Cinematograph, as it was also known, pictures from the regimental sports of the 7th Battalion Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry were shown alongside comedies and wartime news bulletins.
The Oxford Cinematograph Theatre, George Street, today and tomorrow, a sensational recruiting film, England Expects, a bugle call to patriotic citizens, and latest war pictures, splendid orchestra, continuous performances, 2 to 10:30, prices as usual.
Across the road opposite, you can see what used to be the City of Oxford High School for Boys, now the Faculty of Modern History. This is where T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia, went to school from the age of 8 in 1896. Thomas Edward Ned Lawrence is more associated with the exotic Middle East than the traditionally English university town of Oxford, yet this is where his roots lie. Lawrence was a loner and did not regularly attend tutorials and lectures, but nonetheless graduated with a first-class degree, in part due to his very fine thesis based on first-hand knowledge of French and Syrian castles obtained in travels on foot and by bicycle during his long summer vacations. In Jesus College, a portrait of Lawrence in Arab clothes now hangs in the hall, while his bust may be seen in the chapel. Later, Lawrence was awarded a demyship at Magdalen College and used the funds from this to support a British Museum archaeological expedition to the Middle East. He was later recruited by the British Army to conduct intelligence work, capitalising on his excellent geographical knowledge of the region. In 1916, Lawrence met one of the Arab leaders, Sharif Faisal, and this meeting was the beginning of Lawrence's famous involvement with the Arab Revolt. For the next 2 years until the end of the war, Lawrence lived and fought alongside Sharif Faisal and other tribal leaders. Lawrence died from a motorcycle accident near his home in Dorset on 19th May 1935. His headstone simply records that he was a fellow of All Souls College, Oxford.
Now go to location 9 on your map NOPS Property Lettings at 151 Walton Street. Location 9, Ruskin College. You should now be standing outside NOPS Property Lettings at 151 Walton Street.
The grand building across the road on the left, on the corner of Walton Street and Worcester Place, used to be Ruskin College, founded to provide university standard education for the working classes. In 1914, however, the college closed as an educational establishment, as it was felt that it could not function effectively in wartime, and the Belgian Relief Committee established its headquarters here in September. In the same month, it provided housing for 35 to 50 refugees. The college was attractive to a committee because of the building's internal conveniences and proximity to the town centre. Whilst London was a centre of accommodation for upper-class Belgians, Oxfordshire initially received refugees from a range of classes. This was later restricted by the Belgian Relief Committee to middle and upper-class refugees due to Oxford's lack of a commercial centre. Those of the peasant artisan class were sent out into the surrounding towns and villages. The Ruskin buildings housed Belgian refugees up to January 1916, when it became a nurse's home for the 3rd Southern General Hospital. In October 1914, a number of unspecified disciplinary problems occurred, which resulted in some unmanageable refugees being sent back to Alexandra Palace. Allegedly, some of the males were overly keen on drinking and cards. This was followed by the proposal that in the future, a college would only house families of a rather better class.
Now go to location 10 on your map, the Blavatnik School of Government, still in Walton Street. Location 10, Oxford Eye Hospital and Oxford University Press. You should now be standing on the front courtyard of the new Blavatnik School of Government.
This was formerly the site of the Oxford Eye Hospital, part of the 3rd Southern General. There were 12 beds for servicemen here for eye cases only, while others attended as outpatients. Directly opposite, you'll see the main entrance to Oxford University Press, the largest university press in the world and the second oldest after Cambridge University Press. At the time of the First World War, OUP was largely a printing press. Many of the staff lived around the neighbouring area, known as Jericho, and had done for generations. It was a close-knit community. The war led to a large number of trained printers enlisting. By the end of the conflict, 356 men, around 50% of the adult workforce, were on active service. During the conflict, there were two main threads to OUP's output. Firstly, there were the standard kind of works one would have expected in peacetime. A major publication was Shakespeare's England, 1916, both a scholarly work and a patriotic gesture during a grim hour in the nation's history, produced to commemorate the tercentenary of Shakespeare's death. Secondly, there was work directly related to the war effort. A great deal of printing was undertaken for naval intelligence, and a series was also produced known as the Oxford Pamphlets, whereby leading academics and public figures were commissioned to write about the war and to expound upon the justification of the Allies' cause. These were published both to raise morale at home and to lure the United States, then neutral, into fighting alongside the Allies. Pressmen were also taking on military duties on a more local scale. Older men, many of them veterans of previous conflicts, started a volunteer unit and began to train men who had never fired a rifle in their life, drawing younger apprentices into a military discipline. This proved to be a valuable training ground for those who did eventually enter active service.
Now go to location 11 on your map, the Radcliffe Infirmary on Woodstock Road. You'll find an alleyway a little further up Walton Street, opposite Cardigan Street. This will take you through to Woodstock Road and presents a significant shortcut. Location 11, Radcliffe Infirmary. You should now be standing outside the entrance to the Radcliffe Infirmary, just past some traffic lights. On the opposite side of the road, slightly to the left, is the Royal Oak Pub.
From the beginning of the war, the infirmary was closely associated with the 3rd Southern General. Its senior doctors were given commissions in the Royal Army Medical Corps and were responsible for wards at the examination schools. One ward of 64 beds was especially reserved for servicemen.
Now go to location 12 on your map, Somerville College. Location 12, Somerville College. You should now be situated by the front entrance of Somerville College, between two bicycle parking areas.
Somerville College was part of a 3rd Southern General Hospital with 262 beds. As it was next door to the Radcliffe Infirmary, Somerville was an obvious choice when the 3rd Southern General required expansion. Indeed, stretchers were carried to the infirmary's operating theatres through a hole which had been made in the college's north wall. Initially, Somerville took all ranks, but it was soon decided that the type of accommodation, lots of small rooms, made it more suitable for officers. In the Somerville Annual Report, 1915, the following change in college rules was noted.
In the old days, you paid a threepenny fine per court if you crossed the tennis lawns in heel shoes. Today these lawns are given up to cricket and crutches.
Vera Brittain, who went on to become a famous writer, feminist and pacifist, studied here in the first year of the war, before going off to become a nurse and returning later on. In her diary collection, Chronicle of Youth, June 1915 entry, she describes how the college was turned into a hospital, stating she thought it
much better as a hospital than a college. The hall and JCR make fine wards, and it is all so sweet and clean and fresh that it must be quite a joy to be a convalescent here.
Vera threw herself into college life, joining the Oxford Society for Women's Suffrage, the Bach Choir and the War and Peace Society. Initially, she was so wrapped up in academic life that her interest in the war waned.
It was also thrilling that for the time being the neglected war, with its siege of Antwerp, its first battle of Ypres, and the Sydney's prolonged pursuit of the Emden, seemed quite out of the picture. I wondered why I'd ever been so much concerned about the troubles of Europe. After all, I told myself, they could never really touch me very closely.
However, with her brother Edward and fiancé Roland Layton both serving as junior officers, and both to be killed during the course of a conflict, Vera ended up delaying her degree in the summer of 1915 to work as a voluntary aid detachment nurse, initially in her hometown of Buxton, then later in London, Malta and France. Her experiences were chronicled famously in Testament of Youth. The great war poet Siegfried Sassoon spent some time convalescing here in 1916. He'd arrived back in England during the Somme offensive to convalesce, sent home with spots on his lung. His health gradually returned under strict medical supervision. In Somerville, he feasted his eyes on the tranquil beauty that surrounded him, a sharp contrast to trench life. Life at No. 3 Southern General Hospital, in his little cream room on the ground floor of Somerville College, with its pleasant view of the lawns and trees, was a double-edged sword. He loved the Oxford bells chiming the hour, the sound of the piano across the lawn, and the tall chestnut trees swaying in the wind. He could read and write poetry again. However, his initial experience was marred somewhat by the reported death of his close friend, the poet Robert Graves, which proved to be false. When Sassoon learnt that Graves was indeed alive, he began to write poetry in earnest, composing The Father here, which was never published. As he lay relaxing in the college grounds, he noticed a tall, healthy man pushing his rather sallow-looking son across the lawn in a long-wheeled bed. The son had lost a leg, and although the father seemed to exhibit an appropriate concern, Sassoon suspected that they had not got on well together before the war. From this fleeting impression, Sassoon constructed the following.
I wheel him slowly out in his long bed, while nurses watch my stooping tenderness. Then he smiles up at me, shifting his head, and what's between us there, they never guess. For when my boy gets well and finds his legs, and the war ends with no one quite the same, we shall renew, as sure as eggs are eggs, our bitter feud, but he'll be walking lame.
Now go to location 13 on your map, St Giles Church. Location 13, St Giles Church. You should now be standing at the main entrance to St Giles Church.
Near the back of this church is a brass war memorial listing the names of the men of the parish killed in World War I, in chronological order of the death, and within the same year alphabetically by surname. For the duration of a centenary, alongside the war memorial is a new board with further information about the men's homes in the parish and their places of death. Perhaps the best known name on this plaque is the second name down, that of Henry Gwynne Jeffreys Moseley, or rather Henry Moseley, known to friends and family as Harry. Harry was an exceptionally promising young English physicist in the years immediately before World War I. His work on the X-ray spectra of the elements, conducted at Manchester and then here in Oxford, provided a new foundation for the periodic table and contributed to the development of a nuclear model of the atom. Yet Moseley's life and career were cut short when he was tragically killed in 1915, aged 27, in action at Gallipoli, Turkey. Harry and his family were regular attendees at St. Giles Church, and Harry grew up nearby, first living on St. Giles, but then moving to 48 Woodstock Road, now part of St. Anne's College. Harry's father was Lineker Professor of Human and Comparative Anatomy at the university, but died just before Harry turned 4. Harry was a witness here to his sister Marjorie's wedding in 1909, as well as his mother's second marriage in 1914. Moseley had spent most of his life in Oxford, attending Summerfield's prep school in Summertown, where he won a scholarship to Eton. Harry returned to Oxford in 1906 to attend Trinity College on Broad Street for his four-year undergraduate degree in physics. After finishing at Oxford, Harry went to Manchester to work with the father of radioactivity, Ernest Rutherford, for 3 years. He then spent 9 months at the Electrical Laboratory in Oxford, now the Townsend Laboratory, which has a blue plaque commemorating Harry's work there. Harry used self-built equipment to prove that every element's identity is uniquely determined by its number of protons, its atomic number, and to use this number to reorder the periodic table of elements and to provide a scientific framework that underpins the table to this day. This discovery also enabled Harry to predict confidently the existence of 4 new chemical elements, all of which were subsequently discovered. When Harry was killed at Gallipoli on 10th August 1915, he was serving in the Royal Engineers as a signals officer. As a result of his death, the British government began to consider how scientists might be better used in war rather than being sent to the battlefront. Had he lived, the young Moseley would surely have been a prime candidate for one of the 1916 Nobel Prizes.
Now go to location 14 on your map, the St. Giles War Memorial. Location 14. You should now be facing the St. Giles War Memorial.
This memorial bears the coats of arms of both city and university. A parade takes place in St. Giles every Remembrance Sunday. In January 1919, the City Council referred the now pressing matter of a war memorial to the War Museum Committee, formed in June 1917, with the intention of creating a local version of the Imperial War Museum. Henry Hare, the architect of Oxford Town Hall, proposed a memorial hall on a site in St. Giles owned by St. John's College. St. John's College vetoed the idea of a hall because it would block views of St. Giles Church, but welcomed the alternative proposal of a tall granite cross. J.E. Thorpe won the competition to design the cross, and 2 other local architects joined him. Between 7,000 and 8,000 people attended the unveiling on the 9th July 1921, and the Oxford Chronicle felt that this
spoke eloquently of the sad memories that haunt hundreds of homes, and the gratitude that is kept burning in the hearts of all for the men who made the supreme sacrifice.
Taking great care of traffic when crossing the road, go to location 15 on your map, St. Giles House. Location 15, Friends Meeting House. You should now be standing by the gated entrance to St. Giles House. Across the road, directly opposite, you will see a Friends Meeting House, where Quakers meet and worship.
Quakers are well known for their opposition to war, and the First World War was no exception. 43 St. Giles, however, was not a meeting place for Quakers in the First World War, but Quakers did play a significant part in Oxford's response to the conflict. When compulsory conscription was introduced in 1916, Oxford Quakers supported conscientious objectors who refused to fight. This meant providing food and shelter for them on the run, helping them and vouching for them when they appeared before military tribunals, visiting them in prison, and keeping records of who they were and how the authorities treated them. Quakers were also involved in leafleting for peace negotiations in Oxford City during the war. Violet Slater, an attender at Oxford meeting, took part and was alarmed to find a hostile response from the public.
I gave away pacifist leaflets, and a lady came and asked me for my name and address, and said did I know that I was liable to be put in prison. I refused my name and address, and told her I realised I ran the risk of imprisonment. I asked her by what right she demanded my name. She was fairly young and pretty, and a tiger. It is the wicked one-sided press that creates this spirit. Violet Slater, May 1917.
Now go to location 16 on your map, St. John's College. Location 16, St. John's College. You should now be standing by the gated entrance to the St. John's car park. Please be aware of traffic coming in and out.
In October 1914, Belgian refugees were taken in here. The reason for the influx of refugees was that Germany had invaded neutral Belgium as part of a Schlieffen plan, forcing thousands of people to flee. It is estimated that 200,000 of these came to Britain and around 400 to Oxford. Britain had gone to war in defence of Belgium, honouring the Treaty of London of 1839, which had guaranteed Belgium's neutrality. There was widespread sympathy for the Belgians' plight. Oxford academics were particularly horrified by the German attack on Louvain in August 1914, where the university library had been destroyed, incurring the loss of thousands of valuable texts. The Oxford Journal Illustrated of 2 September 1914 notes that
to realise the utter barbarism of this German act, one might imagine Oxford reduced to ashes. Louvain was the Oxford of the Low Countries.
The popular concern for refugees reached its apotheosis with Belgian Day on 7 November 1914. Hundreds of local women worked to make 80,000 favours, a sort of rosette, to be sold from 9 o'clock in the morning. People were encouraged to fly Belgian flags from their homes, and the day attracted immense local support. Here at St. John's, in 1915, a school was set up for the children of Belgian refugees. It appears that the headmaster and tutors were all Belgian, and the lessons took place in French. A letter written in April 1915 wishes the headmaster well with the project, whilst also forbidding boys to go into the corridor between hall and the kitchen. There seems to have been some difficulty with the provision of furniture. In the letter of 1918, the bursar says that they can provide desks and blackboards, but not chairs. The school was closed in the autumn of 1918. There were also Serbian refugees, and the college permitted Serbian Orthodox services to be held in its chapel. Sidney Ball, fellow of St. John's, headed the Oxford Serbian Aid Committee. There were 30,000 boys amongst the refugees that had fled Serbia. Some of these came to England. The London Serbian Relief Fund took responsibility for 300 boys, and half of these came to Oxford. Robert Graves, the famous poet and World War I memoirist, began his studies here in October 1919, his place having been deferred since the start of the war.
We found the university remarkably quiet. The returned soldiers did not feel tempted to rag about, break windows, get drunk, or have tussles with the police and races with the proctor's bulldogs, as in the old days. Robert Graves, goodbye to all that.
Location 17, St. Giles. You should now have found a raised area of land on which some trees have been planted, bordered by black lamp posts. As another reference, there is a blue kiosk nearby.
You are now in St. Giles. St. Giles is the site of a traditional St. Giles fair that takes place in September. In 1914, attempts to stop the fair had failed. In fact, the fair of 1914 proved a convenient recruiting ground for the likes of Colour Sergeant J.L. Sermon, an Oxford University Press employee who recruited some 2,000 volunteers. A Miss Frances Gem of Cowley recalled a visiting cousin and some friends who planned to join up.
They decided to kill two birds with one stone, to have a last fling at St. Giles Fair and join the forces on the same day. Putting business before pleasure, they visited the recruiting office first. They never got their fairing. They were soldiers from the minute of signing.
The morning and afternoon of each day saw the fair invaded by crowds apparently as large as ever, mainly consisting of children accompanied by their parents and elders. But in the evening, the crush was perhaps hardly so great as in former years. The large number of young men who have joined the colours and left Oxford partly accounted for this, members of the yeomanry, many of whom are in Oxford on leave, territorial recruits in their khaki uniforms, and large numbers of plain-clothes recruits who were being billeted temporarily in Oxford, were in evidence, and with true British scorn for the dangers they may soon have to face, were thoroughly enjoying themselves. The recruiting sergeants were busy amongst the crowds, and made many captures amongst the young men. The sideshows stretched down the west side of St. Giles, and, for a penny or tuppence, visitors could make their choice from a large variety of alluring announcements. Gypsy Lee, a true-bred gypsy, was installed in a weird-looking home, where she practiced the mysteries of her art. In the show adjourning, there was a family of living dolls, while hard by were two booths in which many-legged monstrosities were on view. In the next tent, Prince Samuda gave a mystery entertainment, which was well worth seeing. A little further along, a troupe of fire dancers held their audiences aghast, while at yet another show, some highly educated chimpanzees were advertised as Darwin's missing link.
St. Giles also featured in the Armistice Day celebrations of 1918. On Armistice Day, November 11, 1918, a firework display took place in St. Giles in the evening, during which an effigy of a Kaiser was burned on the bonfire. St. Hilda's College student, Margot Collinson, recalls,
"We had to go in twos, neither more nor less, to enjoy the fun. The bonfire was just outside St. John's, and all the time they sent up rocket signals and aeroplane lights. So imagine St. John's lit up in the front by the lurid glare of the bonfire, and behind by the brilliant fairy lights. It was a gorgeous effect."
Now go to location 18 on your map, Balliol College. Location 18, Balliol College. You should now be standing by the entrance to Balliol College. On the opposite side of the road, you should see an Oxfam store and another store marked Flags.
Balliol College served as a recruiting office and barracks. The college was also used as a training base for officers. The course lasted about a month. There is a unique record of the college during wartime in a photo album compiled by Francis Fortescue Urquhart, nicknamed Sligger, an amateur photographer and tutor at the college. Photographs from summer 1914 show a golden summer. Students punting and picnicking, dressed in black tie, and having tea in the college gardens in fancy dress, kimonos, during a party. As war breaks out, the photos show a sharp change. A soldier stands beside a blackboard, addressing a group of other soldiers gathered in a semicircle on the college grounds. Another shows the college being used as a barracks. But the photos and records also show an increasing desperation to maintain continuity with pre-war life. Punting continues on a regular basis, and tea is still held in the gardens. Famous alumni of Balliol include Herbert Asquith, the Liberal Prime Minister from 1908 to 1916, and future Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, who served in the Grenadier Guards during the First World War. H.S. Malik, the first Indian to serve with the Royal Flying Corps, studied here at the war's commencement. Initially, he wasn't allowed to join up, but thanks to his tutor, Urquhart, who took up his cause, he eventually got a commission with the Royal Flying Corps as a pilot. At a parade on the first day, a sergeant barked at him, "Where's your hat?" Luckily, the adjutant smoothed things over, and a special dispensation was granted so that he could wear his turban. In fact, a helmet was fitted over the top, and he was nicknamed the Flying Hobgoblin. Malik also attended Belgian Day in November 1914. On that day, he emerged from the college to find a very attractive Belgian girl selling rosettes. He pulled out a £1 note and asked the girl for some change. Unfortunately, she had none. Malik then kissed her soundly and declared, "I have my change," much to the astonishment of his friends, who could hardly believe their eyes at the boldness of quiet Malik.
Now go to location 19 on your map, Trinity College Gates. Location 19, Trinity College. You should now be standing outside the gates of Trinity College. This is our last stop.
In the passage leading to the Trinity Dining Hall, you will find a display housing the oldest existing manuscript of Laurence Binyon's poem For the Fallen, one of the best-loved poems of the First World War. Binyon wrote For the Fallen while staying in Cornwall and it was published in The Times on 21st September 1914. In 1916, Binion wrote the poem out for the wife of theatre manager Sir John Martin Harvey. In 1959, the family presented the manuscript to the League of Remembrance, a charity founded to help dependents of fallen servicemen. The manuscript went on display in the National Army Museum, and then in 1998 was put on sale and purchased by Trinity through contributions from college graduates.
For the fallen. With proud thanksgiving, a mother for her children, England mourns for her dead across the sea. Flesh of her flesh they were, spirit of her spirit, fallen in the cause of the free. Solemn the drums thrill, death august and royal, sings sorrow up into immortal spheres. There is music in the midst of desolation, and a glory that shines upon our tears. They went with songs to the battle, they were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end against odds uncounted, they fell with their faces to the foe. They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them. They mingle not with their laughing comrades again. They sit no more at familiar tables of home. They have no lot in our labour of the daytime. They sleep beyond England's foam. But where our desires are, and our hopes profound, felt as a wellspring that is hidden from sight, to the innermost heart of their own land they are known, as the stars are known to the night. As the stars that shall be bright when we are dust, moving in marches upon the heavenly plain, as the stars that are starry in the time of our darkness, to the end, they remain. This is the end of your tour. Across the street on the left, you will find the Museum of the History of Science, where our tour commenced.